Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
On December 13th, 1971, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Roe v. Wade.
Jane Roe had gone to several Dallas physicians seeking an abortion, but had been refused care because of the Texas law. She filed suit on behalf of herself and all those women who have in the past, at that present time, or in the future, would seek termination of a pregnancy.
That was the voice of the legendary attorney and later Texas state lawmaker, Sarah Weddington. Ultimately, the arguments presented by Weddington and the legal team representing Jane Roe were successful. And in a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court held that the constitutional right to privacy protects a pregnant woman's choice to terminate a pregnancy. However, the all-male court also argued that this right was necessarily balanced against the state's interest in protecting, quote, the potentiality of human life. It is this balance of an individual's right to privacy against the government's interest in potential human life which created a fulcrum at the point of viability. Now, that is, to be clear, a legal rather than a strictly medical designation. And tomorrow, almost precisely 50 years since Sarah Weddington addressed the court, a new generation of justices will consider a case about a Southern abortion law. The case before the court this time involves a 2018 Mississippi law banning abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, and well before fetal viability outside the womb is possible. If the court sides with the state of Mississippi, the decision may upend 5 decades of constitutionally protected right to abortion. The effects would be swift and consequential. The Guttmacher Institute reports that 21 states have in place trigger laws set to ban abortion in the state immediately if Roe v. Wade is overturned. Catherine from New York City shared her experiences in a phone call to The Takeaway.
Roe versus Wade made a huge difference in my life. First, when I was date raped as a teenager, and then again as a young adult when I had a birth control fail, I went on to have 4 beautiful children. And if it were repealed today, personally, it wouldn't affect me and my body, but it would affect my children and the choices that they have.
Bertha Powell in Santa Rosa, California, told us that while she doesn't believe in abortion, women should be able to make that decision for themselves.
While Roe has not made a personal difference in my life, I had 2 children that were planned, and I am Catholic, so I personally do not believe in abortion, but I certainly believe in a woman's right to choose.
And another caller told us that even if abortion care is illegal, pregnant people will continue to seek terminations.
I have had 1 legal and 1 illegal abortion back in the 60s, in the late 60s. And I was very lucky to have a very competent doctor. And I think it'll be sad for them to take away the right of women to choose for their own bodies. But let me assure you, women will continue to have abortions no matter what the Supreme Court decides, because it will always be our bodies, and we will find a way.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and the future of abortion is where we begin today on The Takeaway. I spoke with Melissa Murray, law professor at NYU, faculty director of the Birnbaum Women's Leadership Network, and co-host of the legal podcast, Strict Scrutiny. Professor Murray began by discussing the connections between this Mississippi case and the Texas abortion ban that the court considered earlier this month.
Both of those cases are challenges to so-called heartbeat laws, laws that prohibit abortion at a particular point in pregnancy. The Mississippi law that's being challenged and will be heard on Wednesday is a ban on abortion at 15 weeks. The Texas law that has been in effect since September 1st is a ban on abortion at 6 weeks. Both of these laws are patently unconstitutional under the Supreme Court's current jurisprudence, which prohibits states from banning abortions before viability. Viability is the point of a pregnancy at which the fetus could survive independently outside of the womb, and it's typically marked at 23 or 24 weeks. So both of these laws are well outside of that marker. The case in Texas, though, that came before the court on November 1st for oral arguments was really taking up jurisdictional questions, whether the United States Department of Justice or the clinics could sue under the Texas law that has been in effect. And so the questions really were whether or not those particular cases could even be heard by federal courts. There's no such question in this case that the court will hear on Wednesday. It's already been through the lower federal courts where the Mississippi law was enjoined, so it's currently not in effect in Mississippi. And so the court will simply take up the questions that they granted certiorari on. So the first question is whether or not the state can restrict abortion in advance of viability. And then the second question is one that the court really didn't say that they would take up, but it is one that Mississippi has subsequently invited the court to take up. And that, of course, is whether or not Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the two opinions that form the corpus of the court's abortion jurisprudence, should be reconsidered and overruled.
Okay, I want to go back for a moment just to establish that corpus of jurisprudence around around abortion. So start with explaining to me and to our listeners why the states are able to restrict abortion at the point of viability. What happens at the point of viability that gives the state that right?
So in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court concluded that although a pregnant person has the right to terminate a pregnancy, the state also has rights. And one of the state's interests at this point is to promote the potentiality of life and viability. That 23 or 24 week marker in pregnancy is determined to be the point at which the fetus can survive outside of the womb and when the state's interest in promoting the potentiality of life can be perfected. Those in the anti-choice movement argue that 23 to 24 weeks really doesn't capture the point at which the fetus could survive outside of the womb, although there's a lot of debate among doctors and physicians about whether or not that is the case. And so one of the arguments that they make is that technology has advanced so much that that 23 to 24 marker is no longer salient as a matter of medical technology. And so they've asked the court to do away with it. Again, though, they've also asked the court to do something much more drastic, which is to formally overrule Roe and Casey entirely.
Now, let's stick on this corpus of jurisprudence for a moment. So what would it mean beyond abortion? So we'll come back to abortion in one moment. But when we think about what is established by Roe and Casey, what kinds of things are at stake? Clearly, the constitutional right to seek the termination of a pregnancy before 23 to 24 weeks. But what else is at stake?
Sure. Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey rest on the right to privacy. The right to privacy was announced by the court in a 1965 case called Griswold versus Connecticut. In that case, the court determined that the state of Connecticut, which prohibited the use of contraception, even by married couples, had gone too far, and it allowed married couples the opportunity to use contraception within the confines of their marriage. But it also made a broader statement about how far the government could go into the intimate lives of individuals. And it said it can't go quite that far into the bedrooms of married couples. The court later elaborated that idea of a right to privacy in another case about the rights of unmarried people to use contraception. And then a year later in Roe versus Wade, it said that the right to privacy was broad enough to encompass the right of a pregnant woman to terminate a pregnancy in consultation with her physician. But the right to privacy is also a bedrock of other rights that lay outside of the reproductive rights jurisprudence. So, for example, the right to Mary is believed to be part of that corpus of right to privacy rights that individuals have. The right to raise your children in the manner of your choosing is part of that idea of privacy. And of course, a lot of basic decisions fall from that. So the question of interracial marriage was not only taken up as a question of racial equality, but also a bedrock question of the right to privacy. Can the state prevent you from marrying the person of your choice? And of course, that has also been extended to the question of whether same-sex marriages are recognized under the Constitution. And it is worth noting here that in the filings before the court in the Dobbs case that will be heard on Wednesday, there's a brief by two lawyers, Adam Mortara and Jonathan Mitchell. Jonathan Mitchell is the architect of Texas SB 8, that law that prohibits abortion at 6 weeks. And in that brief before the court, Mortara and Mitchell argue that in addition to reconsidering Roe and Casey, the court should also take the opportunity to reconsider this entire line of right to privacy cases from Griswold all the way to Obergefell versus Hodges, the 2015 case that legalized same-sex marriage. And their argument is, if Roe is unstable and should be overturned, then all of these cases which rest on that right to privacy are similarly imperiled and should be reconsidered and overruled.
If this decision goes not in the most limited, but in the broadest, if Roe and the jurisprudence around it is in fact overturned, what will that mean sort of the next day?
Well, if Roe is overturned, and again, I think it's a very real possibility, there is a 6-3 conservative supermajority on the court, with many in that conservative bloc expressing deep skepticism, if not antipathy, for abortion rights. So I think it's a very likely prospect. And if it is the case that the court overrules Roe and Casey, in a number of states, there are already on the books trigger laws that would criminalize and outlaw abortion as soon as Roe versus Wade is overturned. So almost immediately, broad swaths of the South and the Midwest would be abortion-free zones. And that would send pregnant persons throughout those parts of the countries who are looking for abortion care into other states that have more hospitable landscapes. So essentially, we would be creating a legion of reproductive refugees going to neighboring states. Basically, what we have seen in Texas on the ground since September 1st is what we would see throughout broad swaths of the country. So that's the immediate impact. I think the longer term impact is, as I said before, I think we are likely to note that this is not going to be the end of the anti-choice movement. I think they will press forward for a personhood amendment, again, to simply remove the question of abortion from the state's prerogative entirely by enshrining the fetus as a person for purposes of constitutional law. And that, of course, would take this whole question of abortion rights away from all of the states, not just those who disfavor abortion rights right now.
Very last question. Would a ban of this kind, whether through trigger laws or the Mississippi law itself, do they both ban surgical and medical abortions? Or is there still the possibility of medical abortion, which I recognize has to happen quite early in a pregnancy? But is this about the method and mean of the procedure, or are both truly banned?
So it's a terrific question. And in the past, I think anti-choice restrictions have delineated between surgical abortions on the one hand and medication abortions on the other. But with some of these so-called heartbeat laws, which just prohibit abortion at a particular time during pregnancy, especially Texas SB 8, which bans abortion at just 6 weeks, 6 weeks is the period when a medication abortion is actually the preferred option of most physicians, if the individual is even seeking abortion care at that point, because she knows she is pregnant. It's not always the case that someone does know that they are pregnant at that point in the pregnancy. So these heartbeat laws seem to sweep broadly to include not just surgical abortions, but also any kind of abortion. So very different from some of the other abortion restrictions, which actually banned certain kinds of procedures as opposed to abortion writ large.
Melissa Murray is a law professor at NYU, faculty director of the Birnbaum Women's Leadership Network, and one of the co-hosts of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. Thank you so much for walking us through all of this, Professor Murray.
Thanks for having me.
A According to a report by Global Witness, which is an environment and human rights watchdog, 2020 was the deadliest year on record for environmental and land defenders around the world. On average, more than 4 people a week were killed as a result of their work. And these numbers almost certainly underestimate the true scope of the violence. Much of the brutality occurred in Central and South America, and more than 1/3 of the victims are indigenous persons. Now, indigenous peoples and communities around the world are fighting to protect the land and natural resources where they live. But their efforts often result in intimidation, threats, and violence. The takeaway heard from the leader of the Shawar Adutum people, located in the Condor mountain range of the Ecuadorian Amazon.
Yo soy la presidenta del pueblo Shawar Adutum. Me llamo Josefina Tunki. Represento a 47 centros a 6 comunidades que están ubicadas en 4 cantones.
That was Josefina Tunki, president of the Shawar Adutum people. Now, their territory spans nearly 900 square miles with approximately 12,000 residents. Nearly 60% of her tribe's territory has been concessioned to large-scale mining and extraction companies without their consultation or consent. Solaris Resources, a Canadian company that mines copper and gold in the Americas, is one of those companies trying to take resources from Shawar Adutum's territories. And President Tunki has tried to communicate with the company directly. She's filed complaints on the national and international level, and she's also filed a complaint with the UN's International Labor Organization. Because of this, she alleges that she's received a threatening phone call from Vice President of Operations at Solaris Resources, Federico Velasquez.
Josefina, Presidenta, las denuncias que ustedes hacen, las demandas internacionales, todo a través de medios de comunicación, está haciendo quedar mal a mi empresa, y la cual en la próxima, si escucho las mismas pronunciamientos, manifestaciones, denuncias, voy a tener que degollar una cabeza de ellas.
So there, President Tunki is saying that in 2020, she received this call from Federico Velasquez saying that all of her complaints are making the company look bad, and that if it continues, he will cut the heads off of someone in her community. Now, in a response to the takeaway, Federico Velasquez denies that he made the threat, and you can see his full response on thetakeaway.org. Still, the Solaris Resources mine is doubling down on their extraction operations, and the Shawar Adutum people are still fighting to protect their territory, the environment, and their culture. Here's another indigenous leader of the Cacataibo people in central Peruvian Amazon.
Mi nombre es Erling Udes Estrella, presidente de la Federación Nativa de Comunidades Cacataibo, FENACOCA, de la región Ucayali y región Huánuco, que pertenece al pueblo Cacataibo en las provincias de Padre Abad y Puerto Inca.
That is Erling Odisio, president of the Native Federation of Cacataibo Communities. His fellow community leaders are being threatened and killed by narco-traffickers as they invade the rainforest, cut down trees, and set up cocoa agriculture and production within their ancestral territories. And the past 2 years of COVID has also hit their community hard.
Entonces, por narcotráfico ha sido asesinado los últimos 2 años, 4 de mis hermanos y 8, ¿no? Con el virus, ¿no? Entonces, esto ha sido el golpe más duro de nuestro pueblo.
He's telling us how drug traffickers have killed 4 of his fellow community leaders in the last 2 years, and that COVID has killed 8 members in his community. So to learn more about these issues, I spoke with Andrew Miller, an advocacy director for Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that fights to protect the rainforest and advance the rights of indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin.
There are many different contexts, of course. There are a lot of kind of economic drivers of deforestation, of environmental destruction. There are different industries. The agriculture, you know, kind of big agriculture is one industry, mining, oil and gas, and other infrastructures. Those are kind of like the licit side of it, the kind of quote unquote legal side of it. Of course, you also have a whole series of illicit actors, as I mentioned, illegal logging, illegal mining, drug production. Actually, that's a big thing that we're seeing in our work in the Peruvian Amazon right now, where indigenous territories are being invaded by essentially land grabbers who are converting their territories into areas to produce coca and cocaine. So it's many different actors, but in many cases, they're very strong economic incentives. And that's playing itself out at a local and national level, but there's kind of this question of the broader economic system and the markets to which these products are going. And, you know, certainly when we look at agricultural products, when we look at beef, when we look at soy, when we look at the minerals that are being produced, I mean, a lot of those are, of course, being consumed in the United States, in North America, in Europe, and other economies, of course. I mean, the rise of China, there are a tremendous amount of commodities that are being sent to China also. So there is a broader global responsibility, but it is important for us here in the United States to think about our own consumption. You know, the New York Times just did a piece about leather in luxury cars and how that leather is coming from, certain amount of it is coming from the Brazilian Amazon, and many of those cows are coming from areas that were illegally deforested. So we can see those kinds of chains, and not just the companies that are producing and selling those products, but we also need to look at the broader role of investors and banks. You know, where are those funds going and what kinds of activities are they, you know, profiting from? And so that's another part of the work that I think is very important, that we look at the investors, and it's important that we as individuals are looking at where our money is invested and what's our responsibility in what's happening. So we can't just blame the Brazilian government or the Peruvian government or whoever on the ground. We also need to look at our own culpability in these dynamics that are resulting in the deaths of really brave people at a local level.
You wrote about Colombia, and Colombia being among the deadliest place for environmentalists. Can you talk about what's happening in Colombia, but also with an eye, as you point out, towards the ways that this global supply chain that we may all be a part of, right, the not only supply but demand chain might be impacting this violence?
Right. So we worked with another organization that's based in Colombia called the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative to write a piece about what's happening there currently. Unfortunately, Colombia is a country that has had violent conflict happening for decades, and there are many different causes of that. They are in sort of a quote-unquote peace process, and there was a lot of hope and expectation about that. But unfortunately, the actual implementation of the peace accords in Colombia has been very spotty in many ways. And we work to highlight that in this piece, and the fact that, unfortunately, there are a number of indicators about deforestation and other environmental problems that are on the rise in Colombia. And of course, the human corollary to that are the sort of frightening number of killings of folks, of activists, of people standing up for their communities. In the last 2 years, according to Global Witness, you had the highest number of killings that happened in Colombia. And that means that they sort of beat out the Philippines and Honduras and Brazil and other countries that have long histories of, you know, being very deadly countries for local activists. We believe that the application of the political will, you know, that governments really need to make a commitment, and not just in rhetoric, but in practice, to protecting human rights, to protecting the environment. You know, they really need to go after the root causes. There are often actions that are taken to sort of demonstrate that they're doing things, but they're not really necessarily getting to the root causes. And so, for example, in Colombia, they launched a whole operation this year to go after deforestation in national parks. But really what they did was mostly arrest kind of the low-level people who were just trying to subsist at a local level. And they didn't necessarily go after companies or the economic interests or the investors or the higher level kind of economic and political interests that are really behind the deforestation and what's happening. So, you know, we made recommendations to the current president of Colombia, Iván Duque, who's very much sort of presenting himself. He was at the UN General Assembly in September. He was at the climate summit in Glasgow, presenting himself as an environmental champion. And our op-ed was saying, look, there needs to be a real implementation of the peace accord. There needs to be a ratification and an implementation of the Escazú agreement, which is a regional environmental agreement that Latin American countries are signing on to, but that has a strong component related to protection of local defenders. But we also make recommendations to the Biden administration. And there's been a lot of discussion in the Biden administration about protection of the environment and climate. They launched a strategy at the climate summit for protecting tropical forests. And one of our key messages is that any strategy for climate really must center the protection of these local activists, because they are the front lines. They are the last line of defense often. And there are many things that the US government can and should be doing, and other governments can and should be doing, to support those local activists.
Andrew Miller is an advocacy director for Amazon Watch. Thank you for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
On the next Radiolab, the story of a chimp who never got the chance to be a chimp.
It's called Lucy Growing Up Human.
She quickly learned to hold her own bottle. At 2 months, her eyes would focus.
A chimpanzee daughter in a psychotherapist's family.
At 3 months, she was trying to climb out of her crib to go to people. She was so responsive to being looked at.
Lucy from Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're back with The Takeaway. Take a listen to some of the troubling headlines that have filled our airwaves in recent years.
Experts say the many pictures and inflammatory words on the website featuring 21-year-old Dylan Roof reveal a lot about him and his recent embrace of white supremacy theories.
A judge sentenced avowed white supremacist James Fields Jr. to life plus 419 years.
A federal jury now ordering white nationalist leaders and organizations to pay more than $25 million in damages to 9 victims.
A recent report by the Associated Press found that there are white supremacists working as prison guards across Florida's incarceration system. Their actions include assaulting prisoners and intimidating coworkers of color, often without consequences. And according to a report by the Center for Extremism of the Anti-Defamation League, white supremacist propaganda spiked in 2020. So what responsibilities do journalists and scholars have to understand and to assist the public with understanding the history, consequences, and current manifestations of white supremacy? I spoke with Kathleen Ballou, co-editor of the new book, A Field Guide to White Supremacy, and Jamel Bowie, a New York Times opinion columnist who wrote a chapter for the book titled The Pain We Still Need to Feel. I asked Jamel to reflect on the piece.
So I wrote that piece on the occasion of the opening of the memorial to lynching down in Montgomery, Alabama, created and opened by the Equal Justice Initiative and the accompanying museum. It's quite something to visit. It is a memorial to the victims of lynching across the country, but specifically in the South. And I was reflecting on recent racial violence in the country, the Charleston shooting, obviously, but also these smaller events that had happened since the election of President Trump in 2016, and just reflecting on the idea that racialized violence doesn't simply happen and then kind of vanish into the ether. It has an impact. It has an effect over time. It affects communities. It affects people. It affects psychologies. And trying to understand how it affects communities and psychologies and politics, I think, is an important project for especially in a moment when you had, or I think when you still have, an overtly racialized nationalism that's ascendant.
Kathleen, building on that response from Jamel, that racial violence doesn't just happen and then, you know, recede and go away. There's these pathways left in our politics, in our geography, in our biology, even. Talk to me about what a field guide is and why we need a field guide for white supremacy.
In the academy, I have an enormous amount of thinking and writing about white supremacy as a category, ranging from legal categories of exclusion, to structural racism, to individual belief. And much of that we have not done a great job of translating for the people who tell stories day to day, like journalists and activists and people in their own communities. So the field guide is really meant as a resource for that. And I think, you know, Jamel's essay is such a standout for me in the volume because the United States is not alone in its history of white supremacy, its history of racial inequality, but it is somewhat unique among other countries that have experienced those phenomena in that we've done hardly anything in telling this story and understanding our common history together.
You begin the book with an Associated Press style book. So as you're talking about this being a reference, talk to us about what it means. So I think obviously those of us who are journalists know what the AP style book is. But for listeners who may not know what the AP style book is, tell us a bit about that and why that works as a resource and to start with it.
So the AP style book is sort of the reference manual in most newsrooms, for those who might not be familiar. And it includes everything from sort of what is the preferred spelling or capitalization practice to instances when those decisions are very, very weighty. Like, do we or do we not capitalize the word Black is one of the ones that has been talked about a lot recently. And I noticed, I picked up the style book and I write about a movement that includes Klansmen, neo-Nazis, skinheads, and then, you know, the groups that now we would think of as sort of the militant right. So the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Proud Boys, The Base, Adam Waffen. The AP style book had nothing on most of that. It had long entries on ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and it had an entry on the Irish Republican Army, which has not been top of mind for me lately. I don't know about others. But it didn't have anything on the white power movement. And this is a movement that has been organized and has declared war on the government and has been waging acts of violence against people and the state since 1983, at least. It was stunning to me that we didn't have that set of information for reporters. And there are also just places where historians can really contribute to sort of the contextual framing of pieces based on, you know, best practices about what we know. So when we think about arriving groups of immigrants to the United States, we know that when they are described in demonizing language like a swarm or a horde, or as a flood or a tide or a wave, we know that when that happens in the reporting, it is accompanied by waves of violence against those communities.
Jamel, let me ask you to build on those insights and to maybe say a bit about writing as a journalist, storytelling as an opinion writer in the context of the Trump presidency and the ways that exactly those challenges seem to be, for those who are paying attention, very much working themselves out in real time during the 4 years, maybe even five if you want to take the year of the campaign and then also of the presidency.
Right. One thing I found challenging over those years, and that is still, I think, a challenge in this, you know, current climate, is that the popular understanding of what racism is and sort of what it entails is really in, you know, stark conflict with what I think are more, you know, scholarly understandings, academic understandings. Sort of the understandings that come from kind of thinking deeply and thinking historically about these things, which is to say that the popular understanding is simply that racism is, you know, bad thoughts, bad feelings, mean words, sort of, you know, prejudice, bias, that sort of thing. And the more scholarly, academic, historical understanding is racism as you know, a structural force, as you know, the phrase systemic racism has recently entered the lexicon, but yeah, racism as a systemic force, something that shapes society, something that shapes, you know, the very various relationships within society. And in writing about Trump and in writing during the Trump presidency, one thing I saw quite a bit was a reluctance to describe him or any part of his administration as racist, in part because that didn't jibe with the popular understanding. And I think in mainstream journalism, mainstream political writing, there is real reluctance to use those terms because they were understood in that manner. I know when I was writing as just an opinion writer, I was constantly trying to clarify for readers and show for readers that you have to understand these things in a broader sense than simply individual belief or individual bias, that these things work on a societal level, that they work on, again, a structural level, that they shape how, you know, disadvantage is distributed, they shape how power is distributed. And that's going to be the most useful lens for understanding something like the Trump presidency. And there was, you know, there's quite a bit of pushback from some readers around that, quite a bit of, you know, readers embracing that as well. But I think it was and remains a challenge for thinking through these issues in public, that there really is this sort of big gap between how the general, you know, readership understands what racism is and how, you know, how scholars understand it.
This is not a small point. When we're communicating, Kathleen, our responsibility is both to be reasonably honest and fair towards the concepts that we are writing about, but also to write in a way that we are understood by those to whom we are writing, presuming that this is not like our personal journal that we're writing, right? But we're actually writing in order to either inform or persuade or engage in discussion with an audience. I'm wondering, as you put together this field guide meant to help us see and locate and identify, how you thought about the challenges of precisely these definitional differences that Jamela is framing for us here, that I can see something, understand it to be part of this phenomenon, but if I'm trying to communicate with folks who don't necessarily see it as part of that phenomenon, do I choose those words, new words? I'm just kind of wondering about that. Maybe it's a translation or a collective language creation problem.
Maybe so. I've been playing with analogies for this very point, actually, and I've come to think of this as a wooden fence, like the kind you find in somebody's backyard, where racial violence and the white power movement are one plank of the fence. And the fence was constructed by people with overt, outright racist belief, right? People put up that fence expressly to create opportunities for white people on unequal terms. Sometimes hundreds of years ago, sometimes somebody's come along last week and added a plank. And the whole fence is white supremacy. So racial violence is one plank, but then we have to think about the accumulation of wealth, the way our immigration laws are structured, the way that our incarceration rates turn out, the way that, I mean, you can look at any number of measures that are still dramatically unequal by race, like maternal health outcomes or educational outcomes. That whole fence is white supremacy. So it's not enough to simply not believe in racism, because the fence will still be standing there. And I think that's hard for folks to understand, because it really points, you know, to those who have not understood it this way, it really shows how far we have to go. But it's absolutely critical, even to something like confronting outright racial violence. One episode I write about in my first book is the 1979 shooting of leftist demonstrators by Klansmen and neo-Nazis in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's an event that was captured on tape. You can see who was shooting whom. And it is an event that is very clearly an exercise of racist violence, right? But they were acquitted on state trial. They were acquitted on federal trial, and they were mostly acquitted on a civil suit. So what we have to do if we want to look at all of this is to understand, okay, how was an all-white jury appointed in the first trial? How did the jury instructions convey beliefs about white supremacy? How did this whole system concentrate policing in the way it did? How did journalists talk about it to make the Klansmen seem innocent compared to the people who were killed? And these are the same issues you're still coming up in the Charlottesville trial and the Ahmaud Arbery trial and the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Our systems still have inequality built into them. And if we want to really pursue equality, we have to understand the work not only of individual belief, but also the systems that are built all around us.
Jamel, I'm wondering, given your beat over the past, whatever, 5, 10 years now that it's been,
Do you think we're trying to achieve equality? Again, just building on Kathleen's point, if we're trying to achieve an equitable system, is that the kind of forward propulsion of the work we're doing collectively as a nation?
I think that is.
I appreciate work. That is funny to think about.
Yeah. that was me trying to be judicious. I think that is the work that some Americans are doing. I think most Americans don't really think too much about this stuff. And I think that there are some Americans who very much oppose that work. I think that what has been perhaps useful about the last 5 years is that they have served as a reminder that one of the things that I think, you know, some people, and maybe especially people who you might describe as liberals, something taken for granted is this idea that sort of we're all kind of trying to move in the same general direction, but that just isn't true. There are plenty of Americans who think that, you know, received hierarchies of various sorts are good and provide structure and security for society, and find efforts to undermine them to be deeply threatening and you know, worthy of intense opposition. And so to answer your question directly, I don't think that you can describe that as a project for our society as a whole. I think our society as a whole, as it always has been, is a contest between rival visions of, you know, what it means to be, you know, a democratic country. Does that mean a kind of substantive equality for all people, not just political equality, but economic equality? Or does it mean a kind of liberty for those who are at the top of the various hierarchies that structure our society?
So, Kathleen, in this work, if we were to imagine the creation or the sort of, you know, I guess as President Obama might have called it, the, you know, sort of further perfecting of our union, how do you respond to the critique that we don't need to focus on these negative moments, that Jamel's piece about racial terrorism only draws us back into a past that encourages us to think in divisive ways, and that rather than creating a field guide to white supremacy, why not you and your co-editor, Professor Gutierrez, why not do the field guide to equity, to justice, and to sort of our highest ideals?
Well, that's a fair question, and perhaps somebody ought to edit one. But I think, to me, there is a... I guess my best answer is that there's work to do, and I think that people need resources. So what we're trying to do in this book is simply get these histories to more people, and to create a starting point for people who would like to learn more about this. I don't think that it is an inherently pessimistic act to learn about the hard parts of our history. And in fact, I think that what it shows is that... this is perhaps an optimistic viewpoint of it, but I think that what our history shows, even the hardest parts, is the way that people have come together, formed coalitions, held each other up, joined hands, and worked to be included in those ideals of democracy. And I agree with Jamel that it is, you know, our nation is deeply rent apart by these two different visions of what the nation ought to be, whether it ought to be hierarchical with people kind of taking advantage at the top, or whether it ought to be, you know, everyone included in life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And we need look no further than the latest attacks on voting rights to see how precarious and incomplete those promises are. But the story of American history over time, to me, is about this radical promise and people fighting to be included. You know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that was never meant for any of the three of us on this conversation. But over time, people worked to demand inclusion. People mobilized and formed coalitions and did the work of demanding inclusion in that freedom. So to me, I see this as part of that legacy of work.
Kathleen Belew, co-editor of the new book, A Field Guide to White Supremacy, and assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago, and Jamel Bowie, New York Times opinion columnist. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The question is not, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? The question is, where will America be 4 years from now?
You're listening to George McGovern. He's speaking at the 1984 Democratic National Convention and urging his party and the American people to jettison incumbent President Ronald Reagan and embrace the Democratic nominee, Walter Mondale. That is not what happened. In fact, 1984 was the most decisive presidential victory of the modern era. Ronald Reagan carried 49 states, amassed 525 electoral college votes, while Mondale carried only Minnesota's 13. But this was also an outcome McGovern was painfully familiar with. As the Democratic nominee in 1972, McGovern also lost 49 states to Richard Nixon and carried only 14 electoral college votes from the state of Massachusetts. Now, these overwhelming defeats, they've assigned McGovern to the dustbin of presidential history. But a new podcast, Of the People, is taking a closer look at McGovern in order to ask what we can learn about today's politics from his campaigns. I spoke with Ben Bradford, creator and producer of the Of the People podcast.
So George McGovern, if you started where I started, you knew of him as nothing other than maybe the Democratic candidate in 1972 who loses in a huge landslide in the Watergate election. And he's kind of gone down in history as an inept, too liberal loser, this kind of buffoon who falls over himself against Nixon. And the true story of that is actually much more interesting. And you can see by watching the 1972 presidential race how the country has divided along today's political battle lines between the parties. So essentially, this election is 50 years ago, and you go back before that election, and the political parties really are not the ones that we recognize today. They are not ideological in the same way. They are really more machines. They have party bosses who control them. Those bosses pick candidates. Voters are not sorted along ideological lines with culturally and socially conservative people in the Republican Party and more liberal people in the Democratic Party. And by the end of this race, you can see essentially the shape of today's political division form. And George McGovern, rather than being a buffoonish radical, turns out to be this guy who runs this innovative campaign. He is a 200-to-1 long shot to win the Democratic nomination. And by following his rise and fall, you can see all of these other factors that helped shape today's political division.
All right. So when we think about that shaping, right, I want to walk through a couple of different aspects of it. So how much of it is about kind of a broadly accepted analysis that you kind of gave us in shorthand there, right? The too liberal buffoon who loses, and then the Democratic Party then responds to that angst about being too liberal. Is that what happens? Or is there something maybe more structural that McGovern gives us?
So one of the things that I just found fascinating covering the story is that prior to several months into the Democratic primaries in 1972, the big knock on George McGovern has nothing to do with him being too liberal or a radical or anything along those lines. Essentially, the sort of establishment view at the time was that he couldn't win because he was too boring. He had no charisma. He had this dull, flat voice. And this had been a criticism of him going back to high school when his debate coach called him colorless. So it really was not a story of him being too liberal. It is a story of him being branded as too liberal, and not just by Republicans, but importantly, it was by his own party. But one of the things that is, I think, makes this such a compelling story is that the reasons that that happens have less to do with policies. I'm not saying they don't have anything to do with policies, but a lot of it is personal vendettas and power struggles within the party. And we still live with the consequences.
What are some of those consequences?
Well, you know, anytime you see a Democratic candidate being tagged as a radical, I mean, you know, Joe Biden had attacks from the right saying that he was another McGovern.
I'm sorry, it's hard to say that without laughing, right? Oh, yes, that radical Joe Biden, but yes, okay.
Well, that's exactly right. And so this has been a label that has sort of been tagged on Democrats ever since then. But more importantly, what you see by the end of this election, the fallout, the margin of the landslide, is this realignment that I sort of alluded to earlier, where more conservative people culturally and socially, who had been longtime Democrats, parts of the labor movement, move into the Republican column. And McGovern does very well. He incorporates social movements that had previously been sort of locked out of politics. So we're talking about the women's movement, the gay rights movement. People of color line up behind him and gain power in the party and gain new power in politics. And so there's this sort of social cleavage that happens, for better and for worse, over the course of this election. And so that is all also partially fallout from the ways in which McGovern is branded. So you see this later in the series in Of the People. You see essentially the party, his own party, attacking him. And it doesn't have as much to do with ideology as it has to do with sort of the struggle for power. But the fallout is an ideological one.
Talk a bit more about the extent to which it truly is unique, unlike other campaigns in American history.
Okay, so you have to understand there is a major change that happens to the political system prior to 1972. In 1968, the Democratic Party is the real big tent party. They have won a landslide election 4 years before that, so in 1964 with Lyndon Johnson. And they have as much as 60% of voters, or more than that, identify as Democrats. In 1968, the party fractures over the Vietnam War. There are protests outside the Democratic National Convention, and police are beating protesters. And inside the convention, the party nominates Hubert Humphrey, who's the vice president. And Humphrey has not won a single primary race, because at the time, the way that candidates were chosen was by party bosses. These party leaders, who were state officials or local politicians, they chose the delegates rather than voters choosing the delegates in primaries. And the Democratic Party fractures. The anti-war Democrats walk out of the convention. Afterwards, there is a real fear among Democrats that those anti-war voters may not come back. They may go to a third party. And so there's a lot of angst in the Democratic Party. And the party leaders say, okay, well, we're going to soothe the hurt feelings. We're going to figure out how to make this process of nominating presidential candidates more inclusive. And so they create this commission. And actually, even though it sounds very small and bureaucratic, it's national news. And they appoint this uncharismatic, boring, rural backbench senator from South Dakota who has no chance of ever being the nominee to write the rules, to oversee the commission and chair it, to really form it. And that's George McGovern, of course. So McGovern really creates the modern primary system, or helps write the rules and oversees it. And then he uses those rules to run a campaign. So all of a sudden, this sort of fundamental way that the parties operate, which is the party bosses choosing candidates, that's out the window. And instead, the people who have the best chance are the people who can turn out their voters. And so McGovern starts as a 200-to-1 long shot, but he is the anti-war candidate at a time when Vietnam is continuing and it's getting more and more unpopular. And, you know, tens of thousands of people have died. And he has the record of being anti-war, and he is strongly against it. He says, if you vote for me, I will end it. And so his campaign is this huge grassroots movement, and it incorporates other, as I mentioned, social issues and the social movements of the time. He's this kind of egalitarian guy who says, you know, people should be equal. And so that all sort of, and of course, you know, a lot of anti-war voters are young people, college educated and liberal. And that, of course, colors how he is viewed himself. But, you know, this campaign really is unlike any other, because he appeals to the people rather than needing to appeal to party bosses. And that has all kinds of knock-on effects.
If there is one key story that you want us to take away from the podcast, is it about these divisions? Is it about the fact that we have misunderstood McGovern? Or is it something else?
My driving focus for telling this story was the question of how did we get here? And looking at it through the lens of this presidential race. You know, when I started, I didn't know very much about George McGovern other than this idea of this kind of too liberal loser and this landslide race. And looking at what the country looked like before, and of course it was very divided because America has always been divided, but looking at the shape of American division and the way that it was articulated in politics. And then as I looked at this story and seeing how that changed and how this guy who has gone down as an all-time loser instead placed these incredibly important roles, some intended, some not intended. And I just think that that is the thing that is really incredible. So for people who are wondering, you know, how did this happen today? How did we get to this sort of extreme polarization where we have this conservative party and this more liberal party? There's kind of this big rift between them. You can see those forces here in this story.
Ben Bradford is creator and producer of the podcast Of the People. Thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Thank you.
Before we take off, we have another transformative takeaway for you. Broadway lost a legend this weekend. Stephen Sondheim, the beloved composer and lyricist, died at the age of 91. He was one of the greats of 20th century musical theater, the man behind some of your favorite Broadway shows, like Sweeney Todd.
What you rush, what you hurry? You gave me such a fright, I thought you was a ghost. Half a minute, can't you sit, sit you down, sit? All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come in for a pie, sir?
Sunday in the Park with George.
I've nothing to say.
You have many things.
Well, nothing that's not been said.
Said by you, though,
I do not know where to go.
And nor did I.
I want to make things that count. Things that will
I did what
be
I had to do.
What am I to do?
And Into the Woods.
You've changed. You're daring. You're different in the woods.
His influence could be felt everywhere in musical theater. He was a giant in the sky. Some even say we wouldn't have musical theater artists like Jonathan Larson or Lin-Manuel Miranda without Sondheim. So we send our deepest condolences to his friends and family and everyone he touched with his transformative life. Now, if you know anyone you think is transformative and should be recognized on The Takeaway, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. Catch us back here tomorrow.